This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's the weather's picking up. It's getting to be a little bit more warm. The sun's coming out, and can't wait for the summer.
All right. It's all looking good up here too, except
fantastic.
We're less smoggy up here. But that's just you guys have to deal with it. All right. Good to hear your voice.
All right. Well, today we've got a couple of questions, one on a cram circuit that Dr. Lyle, you've talked about in previous podcasts, and also on a couple of the live Facebook videos. And then we've got a couple of questions on personality, friends, and also about more esteem dynamics. So we'll take away with the plant-based question. Dear Dr. Lyle, despite being 100% whole foods plant-based, I'm still have a very active cram circuit. It's usually on low calorie dense foods like fruits or potatoes, beans, etc. So it's not causing me excess weight, but eating into the pain invariably makes me feel bad, induces sleepiness, and other negative side effects. Could you please comment on how various combinations of personality traits might impact one's ability to conquer this cram circuit in particular and step away from the table when I'm satiated? For example, I'm unlucky enough to have relatively high disagreeableness, low emotional stability, low conscientiousness, and I can remember first activating my cram circuit around 8 years old when my mom cooked Purdue oven stuffer roasters with potatoes, and I would cut it all up into a big mound with lots of chicken fat and go to town. So despite me being 100% whole foods plant-based now, I still struggle with this deeply ingrained pattern.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, I believe there's a I think I've spotted a bit of a psychometric problem with some people trying to analyze themselves with any online tests about the Big Five. And that is that I think there's a tendency for the high conscientious people to actually underestimate themselves. I think it's a very curious thing. And these kinds of tests have not been through some of the tricky, rigorous psychometric techniques that we need to do some other psychological testing over the years. So I have a feeling that sometimes there may be a subgroup here that is not responding to the questions the way we might want them to. So the person that asked this question and is talking about this kind of history strikes me as they're probably quite high in conscientiousness. Now, except that they feel low in conscientiousness because they're not doing everything just perfectly. You see how that could be. Now, so I'm not so sure about personality issues with respect to the cram circuits particularly, other than possibly more impulsiveness or less stability, that could certainly be involved. I think it's also probably high openness people are generally probably more impulsive. But this the cram circuit is just to fill people in that have never heard me talk about this, that it's my name for what I believe is a tendency in human nature to eat past normal satiety levels when there are high calorie dense foods available. This would make sense to me from an evolutionary point of view. It's certainly going to be behavior you're going to see in animal behavior when you put rich food in an animal cage. And so it would have been an evolutionary sound strategy that humans, when they came across high-calorie dense foods, particularly in times when they would have had them in abundance, that they would cram them in. In other words, they would eat past normal satiety levels. Now, an herbivore with a single kind of food, like a koala bear eating eucalyptus leaves, would never have this characteristic, because they would never have a food stuff that would be, 300, 400, 500% more calorically rich than their normal chow. And so they wouldn't have this as a tendency to do this, because they would never eat anything other than their normal chow, and it's going to be within very narrow parameters in terms of calorie density. But human beings are hunter-gathering omnivores, and so as a result, occasionally they would get very rich foods, in fact, fairly periodically. So meat would have been a rich food that human beings would gladly look forward to at 800 calories a pound, not necessary for optimum human functioning. However, it would have been necessary many times in order to survive, just to get enough calories. And so as a result, meat also would not have come in regular amounts, i.e. dollars per hour, in the way that digging potatoes and foraging for berries would be fairly predictable. Meat would be come in enormous success and great famine. It would have been a highly variable food source, and so when, and also highly perishable. So when a major killing was made, the right thing to do would be to cram up to the gills, which is exactly what the big predators do, because they don't know when they're going to make another kill again. So that being the case, the problem is that this wouldn't have been a problem at all for early humans. But in the modern environment, that same tendency can be essentially conditioned to where the point is that where it would have happened only, once or twice a month, now it can be happening every day. And if something happens every day or nearly every day, what happens is that your nervous system essentially anticipates it and therefore gets ready to deal with it. And in this case, it would mean that even after you were full, it would expect you to continue to eat and therefore essentially drive digestive enzymes and neurochemistry that is preparing for the onslaught of the cram. So you can condition a cram circuit to the point where even after you're full, you will be getting feelings like you should still be continuing to eat. And that's what I call the conditioned cram. Now, this person's telling us that they are cramming on foods that are not calorically rich, which is rare, but it is something that is occasionally seen, I would say, in general, out of very high conscientious people. Okay, those are going to be the people that are going to be doing this. Now, so there's nothing unusual about this other than the food choices that the person's making, which I believe are probably excellent ones. He's eating into the pain. In other words, he's actually having this happen. The way out of this is to understand that you have a counter-conditioning process that you must go through. And so you have to understand this is the equivalent of being addicted to cigarettes, not in terms of health consequences, but in terms of the schema that this thing is, that it's following. So if you're a cigarette smoker, you're kind of on a timing clock where you're going to smoke, say, once an hour. And so your nervous system is anticipating that. It's building up neurochemistry in order to diffuse the impact of the nicotine. And if you don't get that nicotine, then the defense against the nicotine sits in your nervous system and actually causes you an uncomfortable feeling that we call craving. And then when you smoke the cigarette, the nicotine and the internally designed deactivator of that nicotine meet in the middle, and they diffuse each other or counteract each other, and therefore you feel a relief. So that is a highly reinforcing cycle that takes place. And this person is undoubtedly has set up this very same process with respect to food. So when you're full, you are expecting to cram, and if you do not cram, it's going to be uncomfortable. you're going to crave the cramp. So even though you eat into the pain, the system is ready for you to do it, and there is a comfort in essentially having all those digestive enzymes and anything else that has been released, you know, close the loop on that process. Now, I don't know if it's digestive enzyme or not. I'm actually speculating that that's true. But I'm confident that the craving that people feel once they're full is an engineered condition phenomenon. That isn't my theory. That's something that's been discovered. Now, now what do we do about this? Well, you can know that you have to go through a counter-conditioning process that is probably going to take, you know, a week to get through the worst of it, where you just have to white-knuckle it and not do it. And people will jump up and down and say, yes, but what if I can't do it? It's like, well, then you're addicted to cigarettes for your whole life and you die of lung cancer. In other words, there are consequences to not breaking conditioning paradigms. Conditioning paradigms are, depending upon what substance we're talking about, they can be very difficult to break. And so processed food, for example, can be pretty difficult. It's not nearly as hard as cigarettes, by the way. It's not as potent as cigarettes. So anybody that craves that chocolate and is saying, oh, my God, I just craved the chocolate, I understand that you are that you do have an addictive-like process, but it is not as intense as somebody getting off cigarettes. As someone who has watched thousands of people get off of various sundry substances, I can tell you that getting off cigarettes is tougher. Now, that doesn't mean this is trivial. And in this case, we're not getting away from even processed foods. We're just getting away from a conditioning paradigm of cramming. Now, it's interesting. All of these eating type things and their problems associated with them, whether it be the neuroadaptation to super rich foods, and so we only like the taste of rich foods, or a conditioned cram process, you know, white knuckling it is one way. There's also another technique that we rarely talk about here, but you know, people know me as being, many people know that I am the psychologist for True North Health Center in Northern California. And what True North Center is it's actually a place that specializes in water-only fasting. So if you haven't heard me talk about this and you just know this as a place where we discuss, you know, personality and romance and love and evolutionary psychology. This is one of the most bizarre, fascinating, and important behavioral adaptations that you could imagine. So listen carefully while I describe the importance of this. This is water fasting water fasting is in fact a behavioral adaptation. This is a human instinct, and it's not just a human instinct. It's throughout the animal kingdom. So when animals get ill, they fast. The reason for this is that they are better off not putting new food in their mouths. They're better off getting under a bush and hiding and essentially not eating. That's their best move when they're ill. It turns out that when you do this, there's a whole host of mechanisms that will optimize healing response, immune function, all kinds of things. The organs basically don't have to metabolize foods, the eliminative organs and the filtering mechanisms like the liver and kidneys, basically things get much easier. And so this is a spectacular opportunity for the body to get well and to give it its best chance to survive. And it turns out that you can also do it electively. So animals wouldn't do this selectively, that not if they're not ill. But it turns out that human beings can use this selectively and actually improve their health over where they are by using this technique. So it is also the case that in addition to using water fasting, which is a completely and utterly natural adaptation, but we can use it electively, it can also be the case that it, of course, will do an awful lot of things along the purely digestive and taste preference domains. So as you'd expect, if you put any sensory system under total deprivation, that system will recover its sensitivity faster than in any possible way. So the if your eyes are overwhelmed with bright lights, if you completely shut off all access to light, even so you can't even see any light through your eyelids, it's going to turn out that the sensitivity to light will recover quicker than if you have yourself in a room of, if you just dial down the lights. So the same thing is true, well, in any sensory domain. So the you will become more sensitive to sound if we completely have no sound in the background. And now your ears become very acutely sensitive to the slightest noise. Okay, so the same thing is true of taste. So if you are not enjoying the taste of whole natural foods and you've heard that it's a good idea for your health, then one of the smartest things that you could possibly do would be to water fast. So you might do it for a day, and it turns out that even in a day, 24 hours, you will increase your sensitivity to the taste of food. Now you can imagine what will happen if you do that for several days. So it will turn out that people that thought that they could not stand food that wasn't laden with fat and salt are suddenly willing and eagerly eating foods that are whole natural out of the garden 5 or 6 days later after a water fast, because the taste buds have changed dramatically in the same way that your eyes could change dramatically in their sensitivity if you go into a dark room and then you go to a light room. So this is water fasting, and this is a spectacular potential that sits under the nose of modern medicine, and modern medicine barely knows about it. Now it's starting to get more traction. We published some significant works in the field, and others are extremely interested. Major academics throughout the United States and around the world. So this is now finally getting out of the whack job arena and into the arena of serious consideration and scholarship, and it's superb. Now, why am I saying all this? Well, for one thing, our questioner here is struggling with a condition-crammed circuit. They're not struggling with the pleasure trap, but they're struggling with a nervous system that appears to be conditioned to cramming. The ultimate abstinence for this would be a water fast. And so I would recommend this person might go 2 or 3 days, maybe a couple days on their own, don't eat anything. And let's see if we can resensitize those nerves to the point where when you eat an intermediate level of food, that feels, you know, that we've quieted down the conditioning paradigm and essentially broken its predictive cycle. Now, that might not do it, but even 2 or 3 days might do it. And it might be easier for you to go 2 or 3 days on water over a long weekend than it would be for you to try to eat intermediately and stop. So that's one thing. The other reason, actually, as it turns out, fortuitous question, at True North Health Center, we are well known in this arena of the world, and Alan Goldhammer, my good friend who runs the place, is very reasonable and cost conscious, and so therefore it's not particularly expensive, and so something that is really good for you and not very expensive gets very popular, and you can't get into the place if you wanted to. But right now the waiting list is 3 or 4 months to get in. It's great experience. Helps people turn their lives around. It helps them get out of the pleasure trap. It helps them move through a variety of health conditions, lose weight, reverse their diabetes, reverse their high blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. However, sounds good. You don't hear me promoting it because there's no reason to promote it because you can't get in. It's good for you to know about it in case you want to go someday and plan in advance. But it turns out that we have a new center. We have a new place to go, and the new place to go is being opened by nobody other than your host, Nate G. Nate G, I'm now going to expose him. Nate G is actually Dr. Nathan Gershfeld, and he was a staff doctor at True North Health Center for several years where he learned this technique from the inside out. And we lost Nathan because he wanted to go back down to Southern California towards his roots. But now he is opening a new facility is it Yorba Linda? Is that where mm-hmm. you are?
Yep.
In mm-hmm. Yorba Linda in Orange County. And it's a small, elite, nice place where you get this very same type of service and very same type of process where people that are interested in having this experience for reasonable, very reasonable, you know, rates, just True North like, where you get an exquisite place to slow down, take a water fast, have someone who really knows what they're doing to supervise the process. This is obviously a big ad for my friend Nate here, but the reason why I'm saying it is that this is a great opportunity for people to be able to do this if they are interested in this kind of an experience, and one that you don't have to wait 4 months to get in. So I've exposed you. I gave you an ad, and I'd say a lot more, and I will in the future, because I think this is just a fabulous thing. I've been trying to talk you into this for a long time. You know, I finally wore you down. And I'm really looking forward to this all coming together and giving, and you basically offering this for folks to have a great experience. All right?
Wow.
Sound good?
Thank you very much for the endorsement, Dr. Lyle. And for people who are going to be coming in, Dr. Lyle, you're actually going to come and speak at the center in July. So
you bet. Wouldn't miss it for anything.
You can go to www.fastingescape.com to learn more about the center. Okay, so for our next question, dear Dr. Lyle, are we prone to disliking people whose personalities vastly differ from ours? I assume it's not only the highly conscientious person who dislikes the flake, but also that the flake dislikes the highly conscientious person, of course, when they're not exploiting them.
You know, it's a good question, and they're nosing around here, and they've got a hold of a piece of it. So let's look at what's actually happening. That people, what people are doing always is they're running cost-benefit analysis. So it's going to turn out that in an underlying theme of the cost-benefit analysis is not just how not how beneficial the individual might be, but how beneficial might they find me? Because there's an esteem dynamic process that's important here, because we're trying to have cachet in essentially a Stone Age village algorithm, and so we want to be liked. So we don't want to just like people. We want to be liked by people, and it's going to turn out as we step through the Big Five plus intelligence, we're going to see that these descriptions of people are not value free. In other words, the very words themselves convey an evaluative component that we aren't going to miss. So smart versus dumb, we know that the smart person is more valuable than the dumb person, unless we're trying to exploit people, at which point the dumb person is more valuable to be exploited. So, but in two people looking at each other and evaluating each other, the smart person does not value the dumb person, but the dumb person could value the smart person, because the smart person could be extremely useful in helping them make decisions, okay? So there is not a dislike there per se. Now you could say, well, you could find all kinds of situations where the person who's not too swift may be very uncomfortable around the smart people because they can't protect their poker chips or their wives or anything else or their property, okay? But in principle, the lesser valuable individual would not dislike the more valuable individual. You would have to have contextual features of the situation to make that a dislike, i.e. a threat to them, okay? The smart person doesn't dislike the less smart person at all, okay? But they don't find them valuable, all things being equal. So this is how that would work. So now let's move on to openness. So the highly open people do not find the low open people or the very conventional people to be something that they would dislike, except to the point where if there's an esteem process or a control process where the high openness folks' activities are going to be made illegal or in some ways censured by the village, at which point then there's going to be some animosity. But in principle, there's no reason for the animosity, okay? And so, and the low adventurous people are not hating the high adventurous people. They find them somewhat interesting but bizarre. and, you know, stay away from my children because I don't want you taking them to Tibet and, you know, shooting heroin. You know, so there's reasons why the highly conventional people would be leery of the highly open people, because in the modern environment, the highly open people can get into some really crazy crap that's really dangerous, worse than they could have in the Stone Age. And so so there isn't hate here, but it's a wariness and uncomfortableness that can go on between people that are vastly different. Now, if we were going to go on to conscientiousness, now we can see that the highly conscientious people aren't necessarily hating flakes, but they simply don't value them. And they absolutely are frustrated with them if the flakes are somehow impeding the highly conscientious person's progress or their safety. So then they're angry because they feel like they're in an unfair situation and they're being exposed to risk that they don't want. The flaky person does not find any reason to hate the highly conscientious person unless they're in a power situation where the highly conscientious person is being can effectively threaten their interests because of the flakiness. So there isn't any reason why these people would hate each other. It's a matter of cost benefit analysis where context becomes all important. So that's but you can see that where there are substantial differences in personality, you start to see differences in value in coalition general value, and you can see that there could be the seeds of resentment, discomfort, and even threat. Okay. So you can see that, for example, a highly open person, two men, one of which is quite a bit more open, and there's a female in the room, and they're both, say, intermediate extroverted. But as the discussion starts to arise, the highly open person is likely to be more interesting, all things being equal, because they've had a more interesting life. They've exposed themselves to more dangers. They've done more wacky crap, and therefore they're a more interesting mine of possible information. So all things being equal, the female may be quite a bit more drawn to the more open person, which means that the less open person is frustrated and angry because they're getting essentially interference in their goals there. So this is these kinds of dynamics. In other words, we do notice when people have personalities different than our own, and sometimes those differences will wind up being problematic and drive some conflicts of interest, which will lead to what we call dislike.
Is there a jealousy circuit that's different from physical attractiveness?
Oh, yes. In other words, of course there is. In other words, you feel angry, jealous, envious, etc. when other people are interfering, when you see them as interfering with your goals. So it just so happens that probably the most visceral of it's probably extra little juice in the circuits and slightly different circuits when we start talking about the romantic jealousy process, that particular thing. We have evidence from David Buss's research that under those conditions, the jealousy mechanisms, for example, in males and females have been scripted differently by evolution to have somewhat different feelings associated with what they are going to do about the jealousy threat. But certainly we absolutely have that very same type of feeling when we feel like we have competitors in any adaptive domain, in any esteemed domain. Absolutely.
Fascinating. Yeah, I was reminded of a quote when I was reading this question that I stumbled upon a while ago. It said that it's by Nick Saban, is mediocre people don't like high achievers and high achievers don't like mediocre people. And from your answer, it seems like that's actually that quote is not exactly accurate.
Yes, it's not accurate. It's got a disagreeable, dominant swagger to it that we can enjoy, that some of us would find entertaining. But the truth is that it's not fundamentally true. there is much greater nuance to this issue. You can to say that would be to say that the average foot soldier, did not love Dwight D. Eisenhower, which they did. Okay, in other words, they knew that this guy was extremely careful in trying to defend lives. He was, an extremely careful, competent executive, and he felt deeply towards the responsibility that he had trying, to try to save as many lives as he possibly could while getting this important task accomplished. And so the people that were aware of this and were aware that that was his personality, there's a reason why there's a phrase that won I believe it was the 52 and 56 presidential elections, "I like Ike." Okay. It wasn't, he didn't have the brutal, rugged, disagreeable personality of a Patton. He was, but he was extraordinarily capable, and you can see the value that the less competent people can understand just how valuable, highly competent people can be. They can adore them and it can be mutual. In other words, Ike felt the responsibility of those abilities, and he cared, deeply about people, no matter how humble. So, mm-hmm. That quote is a swaggering swashbuckler's quote, but it does not actually define the esteem dynamics that we see in human nature.
Yeah, and it seems like that quote even is more along the lines of a political definition, where it's the whole lazy versus, they're assuming that someone who's not a high achiever is therefore lazy rather than just, being born with different genes.
Absolutely, and different circumstances as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, next question is, dear Dr. Lyle, you explain how well most of us do our best to find someone of higher status when selecting mates. But what about when we select for friends? Do we also seek out friends with higher status?
Well, let me pause for a second here. I don't think we seek out mates of higher status. That's not quite accurate. They're close, and so God forbid I always shudder because I might have said that, and yet it wasn't encompassing what it is that I would – what I would mean or what I would be more precise. What we seek is to optimize mate value. So we're running a total cost-benefit analysis on potential mates. And the mate's status, i.e. when we talk about status, we would be talking about, for example, their objective status, how fancy other people would find them. That is one characteristic of that mate that would go into our cost-benefit of the mate. And there would be many reasons why that characteristic would be important, but it would not be the only thing that would be important. Okay? There could be a characteristic about a particular mate that the rest of the world would not consider particularly valuable, but you would consider particularly valuable. Okay? You could easily have a situation where, let me give you an example. I mean, this is trivial. It just leaps to mind. And that is that the world doesn't particularly give you any objective chips for being highly health conscious. That's no big deal. Like, that never got me laid, not once, not even close, okay? In fact, so when I meet people, if I do anything, I cloak that, for God's sakes. Okay, mm-hmm. So the point is that however, if someone were to meet me that happened to value that very highly, then I would be getting some extra chips for that perhaps. So this is why it is that status in quotes is really, when we're talking about that, we're talking about an objective mate value. By that, what I mean is if 1,000 people were to rate an individual across the major dimensions of appeal, where would your mate belong? Would your mate be you know, for your age group and, you know, and your gender, would your person be a 66th percentile mate? Would they be an 82nd percentile mate? Would be a 36th percentile mate? Would they be a 93rd percentile mate? There is some objective value that the person you're considering would have, okay? And we can guesstimate pretty well what that would be. And so it could easily be the case that we could meet two people. Let's suppose we're trying to trade in the 8 range. And so we're hoping to qualify for an 8. And it turns out that we meet two people, one of which looks like to us like an 8.5, and the other one looks like a 7.5. And so we estimate that the objective mate value of the 8.5, you know, that's a significant chunk higher, but it turns out that we don't particularly or don't feel that much appeal towards them. We just don't, for whatever reason, all the idiosyncratic reasons of who it is that we are. The 7.5 feels like it's very promising and we're very interested, okay? So do we care about that status difference? We might, okay? A strange bird might prefer the 7.5 because it's like, hey, I have to do less mate guarding and worrying about them running off with somebody else. I've known people that had that kind of idea in their head. Most people would not have that kind of idea in their head. Most people follow a conventional strategy that would say, all things being equal, I want the fanciest one, okay? And the reason why that would be is you can sniff in the higher mate value and therefore higher status mate that your children, that your offspring would likely be fancier. So there's value there. It's also true that if you are with someone who is of higher objective mate value than an alternative partner, then even if you don't like them that much and you may dump them later or you get out of it later or it may not work out for whatever reason, the truth is that you may have marked yourself in the mating environment as somebody who could qualify for that higher mate value. And it got seen and processed through the social matrix. And therefore, you've signaled victory in that given domain at a higher level. So you can see that your a potential partner's status or objective mate value is a variable of interest. Okay, it is it potentially is an enhancement to your mating pseudo esteem. In other words, they don't know why that person bit on you, but they did, and so therefore, you know, we don't know what's so fancy about you, but maybe there's something fancy that we're not seeing. And so that is a utility. It's also a utility of passing on fancier genes. So we can see why it is that a person could actually go for someone who is fancier in terms of objective status, even though they may like somebody else a little bit more. So that is possible. But we can also see that it is by no means the only consideration. It is one of a host of considerations, okay? So that's where we're going to begin. So people do not mate with the people the highest status they can get. They go after the highest total mate value of which status is one feature. Now, the same exact thing is true of friends. We run the very same global cost-benefit analysis on friends, and it's going to turn out that their status in the community, let's just put it this way, Nate. If Colin Campbell calls me, I'm going to call him back quicker than I call you back.
I'll wait for
no
weeks.
No offense. Okay. So this is going to – how that's going to work. And so this is we're going to run these computations, and so it isn't. Of course, we are cognizant of friends' status, but that is not the only consideration. So, really good question, and I'm glad to get a chance to answer that and hopefully clarify any other little misconceptions about mate value and mate status that may have been under the hood.
Fantastic. All right, we got time for one more question.
All right, very good.
Okay, so dear Dr. Yeah. Lyle, how does one have an argument about ideas without making your friend or partner feel like you're after their self-esteem or that you're after their esteem? Are most people simply not wired for those types of discussions?
Yeah, we are not wired for those kinds of discussions. It's a really great question. This is an A+. This is another beauty. These are some great questions tonight. Yeah, we're not wired for that. And the human's desire to win argument is very, very strong. And this is and we are endowed with spectacular natural algorithms that, you know, or heuristics, actually. In other words, they're bags of tricks inside the system that look for the weaknesses in the other person's side and then exploit it, et cetera. They'll raise the voice to, I believe, draw attention from the village to try to get an audience, and then we're going to try to win quickly with the bag of tricks as fast as we can, because we can immediately see weaknesses in the other person's argument, and we distort their weaknesses, and we distort our own weaknesses and our own arguments to minimize them, etc. We have selective memory for data that supports our position, etc. So there's a whole host of, you know, I don't know that this has been well researched at all by social psychologists. I don't recall actually ever reading any articles about the structure of arguments or even the evolutionary psychology. I don't know that the evolutionary psychologists are very sensitive to this issue. I don't recall ever reading anything about it. I myself am quite interested in this because as a psychotherapist who's done a great deal, has a lot of experience with marriage and marriage counseling, to watch the gymnastics that go on between a couple that is basically trying to both play me to get on their team so that their side wins the argument is really something to see. And so I watch this with breathtaking, you know, horror as I observe humans at really I'd watch 100 IQ people pull out 140 IQ, you know, maneuvers that there was no possible way they could have ever thought it through. They did it because, like a fish that knows to somehow not how to get caught, how can a trout with a 4 IQ outwit an experienced fisherman? The answer is it's just got some genes in there that build some circuits to do it. And the same thing is true of people in argument. So the question is, how do you do it? I think, you know, with a lot of these things, when it comes to beating your genes, you have to understand that we've got an inherent weakness here for this problem. In the same way, they've got an inherent weakness for now processed food in the environment and drugs and, you know, et cetera, gambling. If you happen to have that chip, you know, you better stay out of Vegas and keep your money sequestered from that kind of thing. You know, this is our argument. People, obviously, there's temperaments that are better than others. Agreeable people, emotionally stable people, conscientious people, these people are going to have a much better chance of being able to play fair and to keep a disagreement from becoming disagreeable. But the average rank and file human can't do it. Okay, that's beyond their capabilities. And so this is why we have a thing called diplomats in the world, not because these people learn anything about what to do. They can just do it. They inherently have the tools to give ground and understand that so often the right move is to show belly and to give esteem, et cetera, and that these people can be naturals at this. Now, for ourselves, if we're not naturals, understand that we have this Achilles heel, okay? And the phrase that I try to keep in mind is from Coach John Wooden, which is we can disagree without being disagreeable. And you're keeping that in the forefront and keeping in the forefront that when we attack another person's position, that we want to be extra careful to let them know that we are not attacking them and that we esteem them, okay? We esteem them. We see that we don't understand the logic that fully supports where they're coming from, and we're not sure that it's right. And so let's step ourselves down through the evidence and see where it stops. And then we may come to an opinion where the two of us, we can't, the evidence doesn't all integrate in a certain way where one person's obviously right and the other person's obviously wrong. And we have to say, hey, we don't know enough. Okay? The social psychologist Lee Ross and Dick Nisbet had a phrase that they attempted to be a meme that would percolate its way through scientific psychology. And among social psychologists, I think they did a pretty good job for a couple of highbrow academics that didn't have a big audience. I think they had just a big enough audience that for a few years I would hear their phrase, because I believe they invented it. And they invented it. The phrase is, it's an empirical question. Okay? And it's a fancy phrase that I've used to give smart people pause when they're so sure they're right and they're so sure I'm wrong, or they're so sure somebody else is wrong, and they're attempting to strong-arm the argument, and I will say, that's an empirical question, i.e., we don't know until we get the evidence. Okay? So we can't solve this theoretically. Those are interesting ideas. Who knows where the truth lies? You may be right. You may be partially right. We're not really sure. But in the end, we may have an empirical question, and that may be the only way we can solve it. So this is a great question, and on my website, I talk about when you're in a bind and you're in a tough argument and you're in an impasse, how we have to use flooding the other person's circuits if you get into trouble. So remember that flood the circuit is your bailout. If you get into an argument with somebody that you care about and you get into trouble, you need to back up and you need to flood their circuit with esteem before you move on. That's the way to do it without having damage done to a relationship.
Fascinating. And you know, it strikes me as particularly fascinating as to how it's automatic. A couple weeks ago, yeah. I had a little argument with somebody I care about a lot, and I was just being sensitive about something. And the argument continued in this type of way where I felt like they were after my esteem. And of course they weren't, they were just talking ideas, and that was my blind spot. But then and this person listens to the podcast and I realized later that they kind of stopped everything, put the brakes on, and then just flooded my circuits for a good, 10 seconds or so. And just everything disappeared. And I remember looking back and saying, wow, they're flooding my circuits now. And I couldn't help myself. I stopped feeling like it was an argument.
Right.
It's automatic. It was great.
Yes. That's fantastic. I'm really glad you shared that. And that's a beautiful thing that you were able to witness. And so you can see, even though it can seem even contrived, which most people will never really quite come to the party that it's contrived, but it's contrived from exactly the right place. Mm-hmm. And it's a thing of beauty to watch the esteem dynamic shift inside of you and relax and realize that you're not under threat and that we can move on in a really positive way. That's a beautiful story. Thank you. Glad you noticed. I'm glad they used this. And it's a great example for people to hear. Terrific, Nate.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Lyle, as always, we'd love it. Love it. So,
all right. Great show. Thanks for everything, and we'll see everybody next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.